Welcome to What is Going Om for New Thought from the Edge of Om. Each week on Om Time's flagship radio show, veteran broadcaster, author, and media consultant Sandy Sedgbeer conducts thought-provoking interviews with inspirational authors, artists, musicians, scientists, speakers, and filmmakers who are working at the point where spirituality and science meet consciousness at the very edge of Om. Here is your host, Sandy Sedgbeer.
Hello.
In January of 2008, the citizens of Stephenville, Texas, were astounded to witness a series of unexplained lights and craft flying over their skies, chased by military jets. These sightings set off a series of events that quickly became one of the most controversial and well-documented UFO cases in American history. Author Ken Cherry is a U.S. Marine Corps veteran and former Texas State Director for MUFON, the Mutual UFO Network. At the time of the Stephenville event, he headed up a team of investigators that conducted extensive research and analysis of the mass sighting for an entire year. Ken Cherry's novel, Mark Slade Investigates the Stephenville UFO, which is based on those real events, is a hair-raising tale of secret underground installations, UFOs, ETs, men in black, sinister plots, and shadow government agencies vying for control of the country. How much of that story is true, and how much is fiction? Ken Cherry joins us now to tell us what he knows that certain factions don't want us to know. Ken Cherry, welcome.
Good evening, Sandy. Glad to be here.
Ken, let's start by talking a little bit about your background. What first sparked your interest in UFOs and led to your 10-year directorship of MUFON?
Well, the earliest incident in my life took place when I was about 7 years old. We lived on a ranch that was in a pretty sparsely populated area. And back in those days, kids weren't supervised, so I was out with my dog in one of the fields on the place, and this silvery object came across the horizon. And of course, at that age and in early 1950s, I had no idea what this was. But the next thing I know, this jet came down at a very steep incline toward the object. There was some sort of flash between them. The next thing I know, the jet was puffing smoke, and the pilot ejected. So, needless to say, the plane crashed. When the people in the little town got together, all they talked about was rescuing this pilot from the trees where he'd landed in his parachute. So, you know, that's one of those events that takes place, occurs in your life, and it's almost like you'll never forget where you were when Kennedy's announcement was that he had been assassinated. So I guess that really stuck with me in the back of my mind all my life. And so I had a continuing interest until in my late 30s, I began to do more research into UFOs and ETs and get involved with investigation. So I had quite a few investigations under my belt by the time this Stephenville event occurred.
Did you actually witness it?
No, I did not. I was first notified by an AP reporter, Ms. Angela Brown, who called me up and asked about the what I thought about this report of this huge UFO that had been sighted by Steve Allen and a number of his friends. Steve was a local businessman there around the Stephenville area, and one of his friends was a career airline attendant. So the four of them were standing outside his home one evening and saw this, what they described as a mile long and a quarter mile wide craft traveling across the horizon at approximately 2,000 miles an hour. The way Steve made that calculation was that he had flown his own plane across that distance a number of times, and he knew at the maximum speed how long it took him to travel it. So, was just astounding to them, and they stood there for a good while discussing it, you know, comparing notes. Next thing they knew, the UFO came back, but this time it was being pursued by fighter aircraft in full afterburner, he said. But at some point, the UFO, I guess, decided, well, I've had enough of this. And he said it just took off like they were just standing still. So that was the beginning of it.
The military gave conflicting stories about the F-16s chasing the UFO. Why did they do that? What was that all about?
Yeah, they did. Some of the excuses they gave were ridiculous. There is a commercial airport not too far away from there. There are a number of military bases in the area, so all of the residents of this community, even though it's small, about 20,000 population, the people are used to seeing aircraft all the time, and they were just adamant, you know, that this was unlike anything they'd ever seen and just absolutely enormous. But this major for the Air Force, who was the spokesman, said that he was convinced that it was two commercial aircraft that had crossed very close to each other and created an optical illusion. The problem being, of course, is that these sighting reports came in from about a four-county area, too widely spread for everybody to have seen the same optical illusion, for one thing. And then, of course, ultimately, we were able to get radar confirmation of the UFO, and so they had to backpedal on their story, but they were trying to make the story go away, and all it did is just added fuel to the fire.
So, what inspired you to write your book, Mark Slade Investigates the Stephenville UFO, which seems to be a thinly disguised novel, and I'll put novel in quotes, about some of the things that happened, and it reveals an awful lot of information. What inspired that?
Well, most people don't know that the sightings continued over most of the year 2008. And that we continued to get these highly reliable witnesses that were phoning in reports to us. Somehow or another, the media just loved this story. And at one point, we were going to interview about 75 witnesses in a central location. And when I arrived there, and this was a little town of about 2,000 people, Dublin, Texas, just down the road from Stephenville, where most of our reports had come from those two areas. So when I arrived, this little town had a traffic jam just from all of the media, from the reporters from all over the country, from all the major newspapers, magazines, news channels, and so forth. There were even international reporters there who were interested in the story. And, of course, the AP wire, a story that Angela Brown had put out on the AP wire, did go nationally and internationally. So it created so much publicity that they were following up constantly. And I was getting calls day and night for 6 months from people who the stories all identified me as being the head of the investigation. So for the most part, they were witnesses, and not only from the 2008 sighting, but some of them were quite elderly people who said, you know, we've lived down here on a ranch for 50 years, and we've been seeing things similar to this all that time, and yet we never mentioned it before because, you know, back in the 50s and 60s, for instance, people would have said we're nuts, you know. But there were so many people coming forth who were some of the local politicians, a good many law enforcement officers, one elected law enforcement officer, a constable. But, I mean, many, many reliable witnesses that came forward publicly, and so it encouraged a lot of other folks who had been seeing things there for quite a while. As a matter of fact, our oldest sighting report that we were able to determine was from 1898, and it was in a the little local paper there that one of the town's councilmen found in their archives. So apparently this area is a hotbed of UFO activity, and over a period of time, as I received so many calls and contacts from people who had information, there were more and more folks who claimed to have inside information about the origin of this UFO and some of the people behind it and what their motivations were. At the first call that I received, I kind of, you know, thought that it was a hoax. But as I had more and more contact with people that claimed to be either from the CIA, the NSA, military intelligence, scientists, and so forth, many of the stories tended to corroborate one another from totally different sources. And so,
Ken, I'm going to hold you right there as we go to break. You're listening to What Is Going On. I'm Sandy Sedgbeer. And I'm speaking with Ken Cherry, former Texas State Director for MUFON, the Mutual UFO Network, about his novel, Mark Slade Investigates the Stephenville UFO, based on Ken's real-life experiences. We'll be back in a few moments. Stay tuned.
The future of Internet radio is here. OM Times Radio. IOM FM. As difficult as it is to believe, there are places in Africa where human traffickers sell albino children and their body parts for use in magic rituals. Humanity Healing International is actively working in Uganda to change this paradigm. The Albino Rescue Project finds albino children who are at risk and places them in safe schools and environments where they can learn and grow free from fear. To learn more or to sponsor a child, visit humanityhealing.org. Humanity Healing is where your heart is.
My name is Meera Batra, and this is How I Live United. Many families have come to America for a better life. I advocate for these families with United Way. United Way empowers them to see opportunities available. We help them get involved with their kids, schools, and network within the community. My name is Meera Batra. I help families see opportunity and succeed. I don't just wear the shirt. I live it.
Give, advocate, volunteer, live united. Go to liveunited.org. Brought to you by United Way and the Ad Council.
Welcome back. Ken Cherry, the organization that you named ACWA in your book is clearly MUFON. You talk about the CIA, the FBI, NSA, and Homeland Security having infiltrated ACWA. Did they really infiltrate MUFON?
Well, I ran into a number of roadblocks with my investigation in Stephenville, and it seemed that the board was putting them in in my way purposely. And so my original draft of my book was just to tell all of what went on that the public wasn't aware of. But as I began to get more and more of these confidential informants that came forward, I realized I could only write this book as a novel. But one of the reasons that I left MUFON is after a dozen years, is that, you know, I don't believe in coincidence, but when you have an international director who was one of the top NASA officials and once told a reporter giving an interview, if I told you everything I knew, I'd have to kill you. There were no smirks or smiles there at that interview. You know, two of the former heads, international directors, were former military intelligence. The founder of MUFON's brother was a long time, a career CIA operative. Many of the consultants do work for, have worked for, or were part of CIA, DOD, FBI. That's just too great a coincidence. When it was well known that any number of cases that were that came in disappeared, and you know that there, you know, rumor was there was a special team that took care of certain ones that came in. But you know, this is well established pattern going back to the 1952 Robertson panel. One of the recommendations that came out of that was that they infiltrate the UFO groups. And you know, NICAP actually had the first head of the CIA, Hillenkoetter, on its board. There were any number of other CIA operatives as members of that, and it eventually became defunct. But I think when NICAP went under, that's when technology, computerization, and you know, all that sort of thing was beginning to catch hold. And I think they realized, wait a minute, it would be better to have one of these running than to kill it. You can use that as a focal point for public reports, and then, you know, use that knowledge and publish what you want and investigate what you want and withhold others. So there were plenty of rumors of withheld investigations, and we actually had one of our investigators here in Texas that went out to talk with a couple, and they were told by the people that they had been interviewed already and were told not to talk to us. So it was just that sort of thing that made me realize that maybe there's a reason after more than 40 years that they've been in business investigating UFOs, they've not come out with any kind of conclusions. I mean, they, so I guess I can't point to any particular smoking gun, but there was enough smoke there to me to imply that there was a gun there someplace.
Now, in the book, researchers investigating the Stephenville incident seem to be more concerned with wanting to know how people felt about the incident rather than what they actually saw. And it's then revealed that this is a put-up job engineered by one faction specifically to gauge how much fear the threat of alien invasion would create in people. Now, we've seen that when people are in fear, as they were after 9/11, the Boston Marathon bombing, etc., that it's much easier to get people to accept losses of freedom. So, do you was that actually going on at the time? I mean, you've talked about that in the book, fiction, supposed fiction. Was that actually going on at the time? Were they more interested in what people were feeling?
Well, there was certainly a fair amount of manipulation of the news to keep the story sensationalized. And we noticed that every time another story would come out, that the number of sighting reports would spike. you know, there was a noticeable mass hysteria taking place there when some of the more reliable witnesses in the beginning that we were actually able to verify their sightings suddenly began to see UFOs everywhere. I mean, they were just people just became highly sensitized toward anything in the sky. And you could, so initially the reaction was very good, but I think that there was an intentional effort to continue to stir the pot just to see how people would react. And so, yes, I do believe there was an active effort to do that, to gauge the fear of the public. And you know, there was another recommendation by the Robertson panel that the CIA began a and this was back in 1952, that they began a process of education of the public, and that they enlist Hollywood. Disney was mentioned, and a couple of other outlets, but Operation Mockingbird came out of that as a way to manipulate the news, where they had control of some of the heads of the major news outlets on television at the time. So all of this effort to educate the public on by way of science fiction, down to the point where you have people standing in line for a couple of days to get, you know, Star Wars tickets, is supposedly to desensitize them to this. And apparently that is the main reason that we haven't had disclosure, is because their fear of the public's reaction. And so, you know, from time to time we have these very massive sightings, occurrences that take place, you know, starting in 1952 with the armadas that flew over Washington, D.C., and Rendlesham, where you had a large number of people involved, where you have the Phoenix Lights, you know, and so forth. There's been any number of other incidents, a mass flight over Belgium. So they've not only occurred in the U.S. by any means, but these are all a part of a long-term conditioning program to prepare the people for ultimate disclosure.
So you've got factions that want to prepare people for disclosure, and you've got factions that want to whip up frenzies around these in order to make people more afraid so that they can manipulate them. Is that correct?
Well, they're prepared for that, yes. Reason being that there are three factions, in fact, one that is for disclosure, one that is against disclosure because they want to maintain the power for themselves, for the elite, and then there are the others. I got a call from an old friend, Jim Mars, who is probably one of the top conspiracy writers in the world. You know, he wrote about the Kennedy assassination. It was made into a movie and so forth. But anyway, he called me in January 2008, and he said, I have a source who's been very reliable over the years who would like to talk to you about the Stephenville events. And I said, sure, I'd love to. So this gentleman said there's going to be a meeting at the UN in early February, and they're calling together all of the people who are, you know, with a compartmentalized knowledge of the UFO ET situation. They're going to have this closed door meeting, and because Stephenville was so sensational back at that time, and I said, well, thank you for that. I'm not sure how helpful it is, if it's going to be, you know, closed door, if it's secret, but at any rate, apparently, the crux of this matter was that the U.S. representative said, look, the others are becoming unhappy with the pace of disclosure, and they're going to force it, you know, if we don't get our people prepared. And so apparently Dr. Michael Sala, who's written a number of other books books as well, had the same source, because he had confirmed that he had heard the same thing as I had. But the terrestrial advanced beings that have lived alongside us for, you know, since the dawn of man, are finding it more and more difficult to hide their presence. And frankly, you know, they don't want to any longer than they have to. And so that's part of the pressure for this disclosure. But if it comes before the powers that be think that the people are ready, they are ready to clamp down and, martial law, whatever it takes to keep society together. And so it's sort of a race. I mean, you and I, I'm sure, would love to have some sort of benign disclosure where the president gets up and says, here's what has been going on for all these years, and here's where they come from, and so forth. But there's still a lot of aspects of it that the public would find very difficult to accept. For about 30 years, I've been talking to people who witnessed UFOs, and they're willing to accept that there are advanced beings from other places, from other galaxies, from wherever. The one thing that I think would keep folks awake at night is to realize that, there are terrestrial beings that are much more advanced than we are who live alongside us. And I think that's one of the main worries that they have, is that not only are they not from someplace else, but there's little we can do to control them in reality.
You're listening to What Is Going On. I'm Sandy Sedgbeer, and I am speaking with Ken Cherry, former Texas State Director for MUFON, the Mutual UFO Network, about his novel, Mark Slade Investigates the Stephenville UFO, based on real-life experiences. We'll be back in a few moments.
The cutting edge of conscious radio, OM Times Radio, IOM FM. Being a radio host on IOM FM allows you to build your show on a rich platform with the power of the internet to fulfill your outreach goals and connect with a very specialized and global online audience, unlimited by time and distance. OM Times Radio will provide you with web relevance, a recognizable conscious brand, and with the standard of excellence that has accompanied every single OM Times endeavor. Host your show with OM Times Radio Network.
My name is Victor Furman. Some call me The Voice. I've always been fascinated with human nature, spirituality, science, and the crossroads at which they meet. Join me Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern on OM Times Radio, and we'll explore these topics and so much more on Destination Unlimited.
Hi, I found a toy dinosaur over on the playground by Smith Street. It had this phone number on it, and, well, I just wanted to make sure the dinosaur made it back to its little owner.
When I found the little sippy cup, I just had to give you a call. It's for a kid, you know?
I know my son gets super attached to the smallest things, even a fire truck, and I'd be happy to drop it off.
We'd do anything for kids, yet 1 in 6 children in the U.S. struggle with hunger. Help end childhood hunger near you. Learn how at feedingamerica.org. Brought to you by Feeding America and the Ad Council.
Welcome back. Ken Cherry, in your book, Mark Slade gets into the Texas facility, an underground facility, meets a scientist who introduces him to some beings that he calls the Others. You've also referred to the Others. And they call them the Others because they're not sure whether they're actually ETs from another planet, solar system, or whether they're from a different dimension, or an ancient race that have lived underground for millennia. Now, the Others that you spoke about before the break, you referred to as terrestrial beings. Where are they from?
Oh, that's a good question. They're as much Earthlings as we are. So apparently they have been advanced and living here as long as mankind, if not before. There are accurate cave drawings that depict flying saucers. There are paintings and wood carvings and petroglyphs all over the world that depict alien-type creatures and spacecraft. So you got to think that it doesn't make sense that they're showing up this often in history if they're having to travel light years to get here. And so, you know, at least one species of these advanced creatures that we've encountered over the millennia are based here on Earth.
Are they living underground, or are they living alongside us?
Well, the ones that I'm referring to live, their bases are underground. There are some public, very colorful cases that have occurred. Commodore Byrd took an expedition to the Antarctic in 1947 mm-hmm. with an armada of ships and 4,000 men and sailors and enough supplies for a military campaign for many months, and they thought that they were going to go there and clean out the last vestiges of a Nazi base that was underground in the Antarctic. And what they encountered were these crafts that came up out of the water that destroyed, you know, ships and planes and men. And whenever they tried to bomb or, you know, enter the entrance to this cave, they were fought back by force fields and were unable to penetrate it. Later, when they returned, Byrd testified to Congress that, you know, in the future we could be faced with an enemy that could fly from pole to pole within just a matter of hours. And so one of my, pardon me, NSA contacts, who is a scientist actually, and created a new system for one of our advanced nuclear submarines, it was out on the test flight of this system in the sub up in the North Atlantic. There were a number of small islands around, and they were submerged, and it was right near the radar shack. And the radar man yelled out, "Fast Walker." And he looked over at this big screen. He said, "This USO shot past them at just incredible speed." And this admiral who was there in charge and for the test looked at him, shrugged his shoulders, and just said, "We see those all the time." And so apparently there's as much underwater activity as we see in the skies. So one of the Rendlesham Forest witnesses was taken, he said, to far below the base there, underground, as part abducted, more or less, and was told that, you know, that they had this base there where they could exit into the ocean from there. So there are plenty of witnesses and things in history that have happened to verify that, or strongly point to the notion that there are underground facilities that are inhabited by the others.
Now, in the book, Mark Slade is shown several spacecraft in the underground facility that have nothing inside them, no controls, no steering devices, and they're described to him as having not needing any of those things because they have a symbiotic relationship with their crew. In other words, they're self-aware vehicles. The crew and the craft are part of each other. Now, is that your imagination, or do you actually have evidence of that?
Several of the characters in my book are based on real people. And Drake is the older gentleman who is kind of guiding our hero along here by giving him information, was an absolutely fascinating man that I knew who had been a young OSS officer and a confidant of General MacArthur during the U.S. Occupation government of Japan after the war. But he said during the war, there were several UFOs that were shot down or crashed accidentally somehow or another, but that MacArthur had viewed these things, and apparently he was with them on at least a couple of occasions, and that's how he got into this very compartmentalized area of our government that it deals with the alien and the extraterrestrial, terrestrial technology aspect. So as an older man, he said that he was a member of a three-man team that gave the final black budget approvals in 1 year. The request was just so huge that they just couldn't sign it. They had this four-star general in front of them. They said, General, this is just such an enormous amount of money. There's no oversight. And, you know, we're not going to approve it until we know where this is going. So he said they took him to this enormous hangar, hint, and they opened it up, and in it were all sizes of flying saucers. And the general turned to him and said, that's where the money's going. And that was in early 1960s. So what they found, some of them were back engineered saucers and some were donated, and you know, some were retrieved from crash sites. But that was one of the things that they found that created a problem with trying to duplicate these things, is because of the technology being so advanced and the need for this symbiotic relationship with the pilot that it seemed almost insurmountable. But you know, one of the things that people wonder about these crashes, a lot of them are different species, and so they use different types of technology, and each one of them presents a mystery of their own to solve. So we have some, as I said, that they've managed to back engineer, and some that's been donated, but that one is probably the most difficult for us to deal with. I think they do have a few pilots who can fly them, and that's about it after all these many years.
There are many stories of UFOs being spotted close to military bases. Is this because the military, you know, are very much involved with these beings, or is this because these beings, you know, are prodding the military or curious about the military?
One of the NASA scientists that I spoke with, and he just basically said NASA was a sham, that this was a public work program. The real space program has been ongoing and secret for, you know, at least since the 60s, as I mentioned, but that he was aware of 17 different alien species, and for the most part, they had different types of technology that they use. So that was one of his jobs, was to work to understand and back engineer the technology. I have a copy of a polygraph that one of the scientists that I spoke with subjected himself to, but in it he mentions when he worked at S4 and Area 51, that it worked alongside alien there. So, you know, you touched them, talked, you know, worked with them, and that they were, you know, a part of the, you know, they, what I'm trying to say, that they were contributing, you know, to our technology. So this has apparently been going on for quite a long time.
It appears in the book to be very dangerous to be a UFO enthusiast or researcher. I mean, people get offed all over the place in the book. Are you afraid?
Well, I have been subject of quite a bit of intimidation, but so far, let's see, my phone has been hacked. I called my phone provider and said, I think my phone is bugged, and they came out and checked it, and sure enough, it was. I was quite surprised when I called them up and said, please check my phone to see if it's bugged, that they didn't laugh, you know, say, yeah, well, you can some sort of nut. And the gentleman said, wait a minute, let us run some tests. And they came back and said, yes. so we're sending a technician out in the morning. But let's see, I've had my GPS on my car hacked. And when I it was giving me directions I didn't put into it, I pushed destination. And it said, the emergency room to the local hospital. let's see, they hacked my television and ordered a bunch of slasher movies. I had a black SUV following right up against my bumper on a dark road, and I kept speeding up, and it kept turning left and right with me until finally a particular place I knew I could make a quick U-turn. I did lose them. Of course, you know, I realize they know where I live. They've made calls all over the country in the middle of the night, harassing people and waking them up so they'll get up and be angry and see my phone number on their caller ID. One time at the end of an interview I was giving, the phone rang, and it was this police department. They said, go to your front door. There's a couple of policemen there. And they said they had received an anonymous 911 number. In other words, no one spoke. It just flashed my number on their caller ID there at the police department. So they've done all these kind of intimidating type of things, and there have been any number of other things. One of my neighbors was a retired...
Ken, I'm going to hold you right there as we need to go to a break right now. You can tell us more when we get back. You're listening to What Is Going On. I'm Sandy Sedgbeer, and I'm speaking with Ken Cherry, former Texas State Director for MUFON, the Mutual UFO Network, about his thinly disguised novel, Mark Slade Investigates the Stephenville UFO. We'll be back in a few moments.
Bringing a more conscious lifestyle to your world. OM Times Radio. IOM FM.
Spiritual, metaphysical, green living, psychic, alternative healing, life coaching. Do any of these or similar terms apply to your business or cause? If so, you are in a niche market with a very specific audience. Conscious Gate PR is the world's leading conscious public relations agency. With a global reach of over 4 million and growing, we offer comprehensive media campaigns to our targeted market. Learn more at ConsciousGatePR.com. Conscious marketing for conscious minds.
Hi everyone, this is Shea Parker, the host of Best of the Best, which airs live right here on IOM Radio every Tuesday night at 8 p.m. Eastern and 5 p.m. Pacific. I'm super excited to bring you expert guest hosts, spiritual discussions, free psychic readings, and so much more. I can promise that you will not want to miss this one-of-a-kind, fun, yet touching, down-to-earth show. Join us every Tuesday night at 8 p.m. Eastern, 9 p.m. Pacific on OTRFM. This is Shea Parker, and I can't wait to see you there.
If you own a gun, you have a full-time responsibility. When you aren't using it, be sure it can't get into the hands of curious children, troubled teenagers, a thief, or anyone else who might misuse it. Your family, friends, and neighbors are all counting on you. Remember, always lock it up.
For more information on firearm storage safety, visit ncpc.org. This message brought to you by the National Crime Prevention Council, the Bureau of Justice Assistance, and the Ad Council.
Welcome back. Ken Cherry, have you ever met an ET or even somebody that you think is a terrestrial being of unknown origin?
Well, I've met men in black types, certainly some other very colorful people, but if I did meet ETs, I'm not aware of it. Certainly, a lot of the people who are involved in this throughout their careers become very stilted in their personality. I mean, it seems to alter them from, you know, the typical person. So I guess that's secondhand is about as close as I've gotten. Sir.
You said earlier that certain of these beings would like disclosure. Why? What's in it for them?
Well, they don't have to hide their presence is the main thing. And just like the traffic in the sky and under sea is getting more and more difficult to disguise or to hide or to explain away, ultimately, the way they look at it, and of course, we don't know exactly how they think in terms of, you know, attitudes, but the fact is they've been here as longer than we have. So in their mind, it's their planet, too. Why should they hide their, I guess, is the attitude. The fact that they don't show themselves is just a courtesy to us and as, you know, let's put it this way, primitive beings. Dr. Edgar Mitchell, whom I greatly respected, said UFOs have saved mankind on a number of occasions, and I think he was thinking about shutting down possible nuclear warheads and that sort of thing. I disagree in one respect, is they weren't trying to save the planet for humans. They were trying to save, it's their planet. They don't want it messed up either. So
we're the interlopers.
Yeah.
You know, there have been reports for several months now that Vladimir Putin is close to disclosing the truth about ETs. It hasn't happened to my knowledge so far. Do you think that every government leader is aware of this?
Oh, most certainly at some level. I'm convinced that that's why NASA has just been cut back and cut back because, you know, our current president and the previous ones realized that, you know, this was a massive expenditure for the public display and that our true space program has been so far advanced beyond that old technology that you know, they, in Obama's case, he's redirected the money into, you know, social programs. And so, I think it's that there are a few people in the government. Certainly, the meeting that I was told about at the United Nations included seven different major countries. So at least the major powers in the world are all aware of it, of course. And most of them have had their own Roswell, if you will, too, where they've had crashes and they've retrieved aliens and alien bodies and alien technology. So one of the gentlemen I spoke with was a master sergeant retired that was part of a crash retrieval team that told me about a number of retrievals that he went out on. He said that we have these radar-type stations all over the world that'll pick up these craft coming into our atmosphere, and he didn't know how, but any number of them crashed, and they could calculate where they were going to hit. And he said, our team went in. We always went in under, in disguise, if, you know, as we were aid workers or something of that sort, if we had, you know, if we were nearby and we were ready to go. But that it was their job to either capture the technology or destroy it if they couldn't, you know, if they didn't have time to get it out. But he died of cancer, and he always believed that it was some type of radiation that he'd been exposed to that was a cause of it. But, he told me about one famous case in Brazil where the crash occurred, and when they got there, these natives were already all around it, and the Brazilian army was, you know, going to arrive there any minute, and they blew the, you know, everything to kingdom come. So it's surprising. The people who control this technology are very jealous of it. They don't want it spread. They want to keep it for themselves. And let's just think for a moment. If we've had these craft for at least 50 some odd 60 years now, and certainly many of them account for the UFO sightings that people talk about, report, do you really believe that that's all we've done with this craft, is just fly around in our own atmosphere? I mean, that is just not the nature of mankind. When we first were able to make seaworthy ships, you know, one of the first things that people did was they explored. They went out to foreign lands and they traded or conquered and, you know, and extracted wealth and technology, whatever they could get out of it. And I don't think we've changed much in millennia. And so there's great power that goes with this knowledge and for and control that they have. And that's one of the greatest forces against disclosure. They just don't want to share this with the rest of mankind.
Now, you're the founder and president of Epic Voyages, the Extraordinary Phenomena Investigations Council, and you've got some fairly well-known people on that council, including several that I've interviewed, like Dr. Sam Osmanagic, Nick Redfern. You mentioned Jim Mars earlier. What are you doing? What is your council doing?
Well, we're investigating. One of the limiting factors of MUFON was they were only interested in nuts and bolts of UFOs. And many times there would be reports that would come in that would link you know, some sort of paranormal event with the UFO sighting, or a cryptid, perhaps. You know, they would see a Bigfoot-type creature and then a UFO taking off, or, you know, something of that nature. And so we investigate all manner of phenomena and believe that there is some sort of linkage that can explain many of them. In other words, if we unravel the mystery, we'll probably understand many other aspects of the extraordinary. And so those are the type of cases that we're most interested in, although, you know, we still do chase the odd UFO from time to time. But, you know, we do have a couple of cases that are very, very interesting that, you know, have most all those elements involved in it. So I had hoped to write a follow-up novel based on that particular case that has all the elements of paranormal, UFO, crypto, and so forth. So we'll see.
So let me ask you this question. Of all the different species that are here, who's at the top of the tree?
Well, gosh, I really don't know that, but there has to be some sort of acknowledgement that mankind is to not be suddenly shaken awake, that all of the 17 or so, at least that we know of, species agree to, at least in some fashion, either that or you know, we there is some sort of enforcement mechanism, whatever. But as far as who's at the top of the tree, you know, I don't think that other intelligent beings, even if they don't share the same type of emotions we have, that they're still good ones and bad ones, whether they judge things in that manner or not. And so I suspect there are quite a few that mean us no harm, some that don't care, and some that would just as soon wipe us out. So, but somehow or another, there has been some truce that's kept our civilization alive. Surely they could wipe us out if they wanted to. So,
Ken Cherry, fascinating conversation and a riveting book. Do write another one. Thanks for being with us today, Ken.
Thank you.
Ken Cherry, Mark Slade investigates the Stephenville UFO. You can buy from Amazon. You can also order a signed copy at Ken Cherry's website, epicvoyagers.com. I'm Sandy Sedgbeer. I hope you'll join me next week for another edition of What Is Going On. Till then, it's goodbye from me.